Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
What's the best mattress for you? Well, if you're an egg or a kitten, check out the competition. But if you're a human person, put your body on a Nectar mattress. As well as award-winning layers of comfort, you can sleep easy knowing you got incredible value. Mattresses start at just $499, and you get hundreds of dollars in accessories thrown in, as well as a 365-night home trial and a forever warranty. Go to NectarSleep.com.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Thursday, the 18th of June. Our main stories: a white US police officer who shot an African-American man outside a fast food restaurant in Atlanta has been charged with murder. The former US National Security Advisor John Bolton says President Trump asked the Chinese leader Xi Jinping to help him get re-elected. And the first ever gay pride event in the Horn of Africa. Also in this podcast:
people need to do things like do a head tilt or a slight bow to say, okay, I'm allowing you to come forward.
How to avoid stranger danger in a post-COVID world. And the Japanese scientists fertilizing trees using bubble guns. An American police officer who fatally shot a black man running away outside a fast food restaurant in Atlanta could face the death penalty after prosecutors decided to charge him with felony murder. Garrett Rolfe shot Rayshard Brooks twice in the back during an altercation outside a Wendy's drive-in on Friday. A second officer, Devin Brosnan, who was also present at the arrest, will be charged with assault. Here's the district attorney for Fulton County, Paul Howard.
What we discovered is that Officer Rolfe actually kicked Mr. Brooks while he laid on the ground, while he was there fighting for his life. Secondly, from the videotape, we were able to see that the other officer, Officer Brosnan, actually stood on Mr. Brooks's shoulders while he was there struggling for his life.
Our correspondent in Washington, Gary O'Donoghue, told me more about the case.
It's really shocking listening to the district attorney set out the detail of this. We've learned a lot more today than we knew already. For example, this encounter went on for about 41 minutes. We're told by the district attorney that Mr. Brooks, who ended up dead after this encounter, was calm. He was cooperative. He was almost jovial. He complied with officers' requests, they said, at all times. And that he never posed a threat to the two officers involved, is what the district attorney said. And as you heard there, some shocking detail about after he was shot and lay dying on the ground. Both officers went up. One kicked him and one stood on his shoulders. They failed to provide any kind of medical assistance for a couple of minutes after they'd shot him. And in fact, the officer who's accused of unleashing the two fatal shots, the district attorney said he shouted, "I got him."
And he could face the death penalty as a result of the charges, while his colleague could testify against him.
Yeah, the district attorney suggests that the second officer, Devin Brosnan, will be a state witness. Now, we don't know whether that means he's entered into some formal agreement or not. He's due to make a statement in the coming days. We understand he's been let out on $50,000 worth of bail. He is facing an aggravated assault charge for standing on Mr. Brooks as he lay on the ground. I mean, he could get up to 20 years in prison. If he does turn evidence, and it's incredibly rare for police officers to testify against one another like this, I think that's not worth, it's worth mentioning, highlighting that particular point, but he still could go to jail. Having said that, Garrett Rolfe, he's facing a felony murder charge. That could be life imprisonment, or under Georgia law, could be a death sentence. And he's facing 10 other charges on top of that.
Now, of course, this came during those protests over the death of George Floyd a couple of weeks earlier. What's been the latest reaction?
Well, I think it's, I mean, people are aghast that this kind of thing happens at all, albeit spaced out. But if something like this can happen just less than 3 weeks after what happened in Minneapolis, I think people are bewildered and shocked by it. You know, did it not cross those officers' mind what kind of situation they were dealing with? That would be what many people will be thinking. And yet here we have another black man, 27 years old, dead in the street. Dead in the street for what? Well, in George Floyd's case, of course, it was for being accused of using a fake $20 bill. In Rayshard Brooks's case, it's falling asleep, having had a few too many drinks in the drive-through for a Wendy's burger joint.
Gary O'Donoghue. The charges in the Atlanta case were announced on the same day that George Floyd's brother appealed to the United Nations to intervene to help black Americans. Philonis Floyd called on the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva to set up an independent commission to investigate police killings of African Americans. His plea came during a debate called by African nations.
My brother George Floyd is one of the many black men and women that have been murdered by police in recent years. The sad truth is that the case is not unique. The way you saw my brother tortured and murdered on camera is the way black people are treated by police in America. You watched my brother die. That could have been me. I am my brother's keeper. You and the United Nations are your brothers and sisters' keepers in America. And you have the power to help us get justice for my brother, George Floyd. I'm asking you to help him. I'm asking you to help me. I'm asking you to help us, black people in America.
A decision on whether the UN Human Rights Council will hold an investigation is expected to be made on Thursday. According to the US National Security Advisor John Bolton, President Trump asked the Chinese leader Xi Jinping for help to win re-election at a meeting last year. The revelation is contained in a book called The Room Where It Happened, which is due to be released next week. The Department of Justice has filed a lawsuit to prevent its publication, but American newspapers have some of the details. I heard more from our correspondent in Washington, Anthony Zerka.
Presidents will occasionally take foreign policy steps to advance domestic political concerns, but to explicitly tie that or mention that when negotiating with a foreign leader, as Donald Trump is alleged to have done by John Bolton in saying that it would be great if China bought soybeans from key Midwestern battleground states and that would help him win re-election. I mean, that is pretty remarkable. Usually you try to build a bright line between foreign policy and domestic politics. But again, this goes to the heart of the allegations that Democrats made against Donald Trump in their impeachment proceedings earlier this year in regard to Ukraine, where they said that Donald Trump was conditioning U.S. military aid to Ukraine on Ukraine providing damaging information on Democratic rival Joe Biden. So it fits into those allegations. And I will say John Bolton in his book also talks about Ukraine and says that that was exactly what Donald Trump did.
I mean, how damaging will this be? I see the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer has denied it.
I think a lot of Democrats will say this would have been a lot more useful 6 months ago when they wanted John Bolton to testify in the impeachment hearings that they were conducting the proceedings that went to a trial in the Senate. I think it will be a distraction for Donald Trump's presidential campaign. It does kind of fit in with the picture that other aides and former advisors have painted of a president who is disinterested or not interested in the details of governing and ill-informed on foreign policy, and one who is willing to sublimate foreign policy to domestic politics. But, you know, so at the least, it's going to be a distraction when the presidential campaign is trying to regain its footing after, you know, what has to be said has been a very rough couple of months for Donald Trump.
And has the campaign to suppress the publication of this book backfired?
Well, that ship has kind of sailed now, hasn't it? Every single major U.S. national newspaper has a copy of the book. They're reporting on it. I think people are more interested now in these blockbuster revelations because of the attempts by the Trump administration than to stop it from being published. It may make it harder for John Bolton to sell books, but it certainly isn't going to keep this information from getting out into the public at this point.
Anthony Zerka in Washington. The Black Lives Matter protests in the United States have again highlighted the unequal employment and income prospects facing African Americans. The overall unemployment rate in the U.S. fell in May, surprising most economists. But for African Americans, the jobless figure actually went up to its highest level in more than a decade. Samira Hussain reports from New York.
One more time, big inhale. And exhale, open.
Yoga is one of the many classes Align, a wellness studio in Brooklyn, has available to stream online.
Start to walk your hands forward as you walk your feet back, coming into a down dog.
Like so many businesses in this era of COVID, it had to quickly adapt from offering in-person classes to only virtual.
COVID has exposed the structural racism that we are always dealing with in this country.
Pam Brown is the co-owner of Align. Before the pandemic, she didn't really think about the relationship between being Black and a business owner. But this is a health crisis that has swiftly become an economic one, too.
We realized that we were in a unique and very special position as Black business owners, a very rare group. Only 2% of businesses are owned by Blacks in New York City and pretty much throughout the country that those numbers remain the same.
Like other corporations have done, Pam and her husband sent an email to their 11,000 members. In painful detail, it outlined the economic divide between Blacks and whites in America.
If you think that the playing field is level, then it strikes me that your evaluation is essentially that African-American people are somehow are inherently inferior, that we just cannot perform.
Christo Braz understands that uneven playing field all too well. He has been struggling since the pandemic hit New York. He's out of work and finds himself depending on food banks again, just like he did growing up in Detroit.
I felt really dehumanized because I've been there before when I was younger. And then to just go back to that, you feel powerless. You feel angry.
Why?
Because you know what that's like. I mean, it's like from inception, from birth for Black and brown people, we were the only ones in that food line. And my neighborhood is eclectic. However, I felt and I kept looking at only Black and Indigenous people in my lines. And I only saw people that looked like me in my line. And that just made me so angry. And then I see all these unemployment has gone down and, oh, jobs are opening up now. And it's like, I don't see that in my own community.
Anger at America's economic inequalities has played its part in the spring of protest. The marches of the past weeks was prompted by the death of George Floyd, but they reflect a wide-ranging anger about America's systemic racism.
We can't breathe. We can't
the latest jobs report in the U.S. showed unemployment fell overall, but not for African Americans. Before the coronavirus hit, Black unemployment, while still higher than whites, was actually at an all-time low. But those gains have now been obliterated. Yet again, Black America is bearing the brunt of the country's economic failures.
Samira Hussain. Still to come on the podcast.
The generation that would come after me would base themselves on this and say, how I love, who I am, is valid.
How COVID-19 made the first ever gay pride parade in the Horn of Africa happen. The World Health Organization has praised British scientists after they discovered that a cheap steroid currently in use could successfully treat the worst cases of COVID-19. Dexamethasone was shown to cut the risk of death by a third for patients on ventilators and by a fifth for those on oxygen. If it had been used since the start of the pandemic, thousands of lives could have been saved. Our medical correspondent Rhoda Odhiambo in Nairobi has been talking to a Kenyan pharmacist about exactly what this drug does.
So I spoke to a critical care pharmacist, Dr. Yakub Sheikh, who is working at the Coast General Hospital, where COVID-19 patients who are severely ill are receiving treatment. And it's also one of the facilities where they're trying out the dexamethasone drug. And he got to explain to me how the drug works.
This drug basically helps to reduce inflammation and helps to open up the airways, and in turn helps the patient to breathe normally. In our settings, for patients who are severely ill, we do use dexamethasone. For patients who are in need of high-flow nasal oxygen, as well as those who are critically ill who have been intubated. One of the things we see is, apart from the viral invasion into the lungs and other tissues in the body, we also see there's an inflammatory activity which happens, as well as other complications such as microthrombi formation. Patients who are having such increased inflammatory activity, these are the patients who are likely to benefit from this drug.
So that's Dr. Yaqob Sheikh. So Rhoda, what did he say this treatment actually means for African doctors who are fighting the COVID-19 pandemic?
So according to Dr. Sheikh, what he told me is that this is a very hopeful sign, with a continent recording more than 4,000 cases of people who've died from COVID. The drug brings hope to doctors who are in the front line by reducing the number of deaths of people who will die from COVID, especially those who have underlying health conditions.
From the results of this trial, it's a glimpse of hope, I would say, because we are likely to see less deaths as compared to not using this drug. As we wait for more scientific discoveries on these trial therapies, I think it is something to hold on and give hope to our patients that, yes, we can manage this condition.
Dr. Sheikha again there. So just tell us a little bit more. Firstly, if you know anything about the trials that are going on, Rhoda, and also I believe that the drug is cheap and that it's widely available to African countries. So just tell us a little bit more about it.
Like you've mentioned, the drug is cheap and widely available across all African countries. This is because it's not, right now it's being discovered, it was discovered that it can be used to reduce recovery time for patients who are severely ill from COVID. But it's been used to treat a range of conditions such as those who are suffering from arthritis, severe asthma, and some skin conditions. And as for the trials that are going on in different parts of the world, including Africa, some countries are looking at trials on drugs that can help reduce mortality, basically looking at shortening the recovery period, while others are looking at potential vaccine candidates that people can use to protect themselves from getting COVID.
Rhoda Odhiambo in Nairobi. Along with many outdoor events, Pride parades have been cancelled because of COVID-19 and moved online. On the upside, it's allowed the gay community to celebrate in places where being homosexual is illegal. The first ever Horn of Africa Pride was held last weekend via Zoom. One of the organisers, Faris Gezahane, is Ethiopian and lives in Austria. My colleague Bola Masuro asked if he was happy with the number of people who attended.
It's a bittersweet because COVID is also impacting LGBTI community a lot more, but at the same time, it's also giving us an opportunity to navigate how we can connect safely. The Zoom event was also live on Facebook, and then on that, we had 7.7K viewer with almost 60% engagement.
7,000 viewers, that's a lot.
7,800 people were viewing it, yes.
Wow.
Yes, and then 20% of that viewership was actually from Addis Ababa, the capital city of Ethiopia.
Why specifically the Horn of Africa? Why are you concentrating the House of Gurumayi to do that?
The issue of LGBTI oppression in general in the Horn of Africa is a lot more staggering than the rest of Africa, in my opinion, because one is, for instance, Somalia is death penalty, but also from the visibility point of view, it's very important for us to highlight this corner of Africa and say we are here and we're trying to activize and create visibility, and then also stand up for our rights and demand the basic human rights that we deserve. Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, the level of activism and movement and also achievement they've done for the past 5 to 10 years is absolutely light year ahead of Ethiopia, Somalia, and Eritrea.
Yesterday's Supreme Court ruling in the United States, where, you know, they've made it, you're breaking a federal law if you fire somebody because of their sexuality, especially knowing that you have in Ethiopia a prime minister who's seen as a reformist. How far away do you ever see that being enshrined in any law in Ethiopia?
under the current government. I have a very conflicted stand on it because he's a reformist person, but at the same time also his values and his background is from the Protestant evangelist part of the community in Ethiopia, who are currently very actively homophobic and transphobic in a space where we're constantly being attacked for just loving differently and for expressing our gender in a different way. Us queer Ethiopians, Eritreans, Somali coming together saying we love each other, we value the sanctity of our life, we mean something for each other, we mean something for a lot of people. It is a political statement for us. I know there are like youngsters, the generation that would come after me would base themselves on this and say how I love, who I am is valid. So that was the aim, and I absolutely believe we achieved it.
Ethiopian LGBT activist Faris Gezahegn. With the number of bees in decline over the past decade, scientists have been looking at alternatives for pollination, essential for growing fruit and vegetables. Now, researchers in Japan say they've developed a new approach using soap bubbles, as I heard from our environment correspondent Matt McGrath.
One day, one of the researchers was in the park playing with his young son, and his young son was blowing bubbles, and literally a eureka moment struck him in the face. The bubble hit him in the face, and he thought, well, hang on a second, maybe soap bubbles could be a way of doing this, because they're very gentle, they're very light. Went back to his lab and started experimenting with them straight away, and found that these bubbles could indeed carry pollen grains, up to 2,000 per bubble. And from there, with some tweaks to the mixture, went out into the orchard with his bubble gun and started spraying the pear trees. And 16 days later, the fruits started to grow.
You talk about them trying hand pollination and drones. Presumably each individual flower needs to be pollinated. So even with bubbles, you've got to cover the whole tree with them.
Yeah, that's right. And what they found was that the coverage of the bubbles was really effective. They had a success rate of 95%, which was the same as the hand pollinators, but potentially much cheaper. There was an awful lot less waste as well. So they were delighted with it. Obviously, there are problems with wind and rain and things like that, which can disrupt the idea. But they're very resourceful, and they feel like they can go on to another level here now with drones, and have bubble guns attached to drones, which would autonomously patrol around orchards, spraying at the flowers and ensuring their pollination. And they believe that this could be a viable idea for the future.
Matt McGrath. In countries where COVID-19 is still circulating, the idea of touching or hugging anyone outside your household is still out of the question. But as places open up, our awareness of the coronavirus is likely to continue to have an impact on our interactions. So will a hug or handshake be possible? Patty Wood is an expert in nonverbal communication and the author of Snap, Making the Most of First Impressions, Body Language and Charisma.
I think we can adapt and pivot, and we need to, as quickly as possible, because so many of our interactions, we're not getting the normal nonverbal cues of friendliness, so we're feeling all this stranger danger, but we don't know how to act. And normally there's specific points where you're making a determination of whether it's safe to move forward. For example, in American measurement, 15 feet away is stranger danger measurement. And people typically stop or hesitate before going forward. So now, if somebody's wearing a mask, they don't have a normal friendly cue, a smile, because it's behind that mask. So people need to do things like do a head tilt or a slight bow to say, okay, I'm allowing you to come forward. And then I'm recommending that people stop again at another point, typically 6 feet or 9 feet away, so they can also reconcile with how close they want to get beyond that point. So I'm recommending things like alternatives at that point to the normal handshake that people might give, things like that also indicate friendliness, like a wave or a bow or a head tilt.
Patty Wood. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on the podcast or anything in it, email globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.